light travels over the curved, silhouetted lines of a stylized apple and leaf. Apple Original Films. Letters collect in a dark void and form a word encased in a box with another word beside it. Sandbox Films. Jagged white lines form the silhouette of a dog's head. A circle appears around it. Dog Wolf. Sandbox Films presents. In association with Dog Wolf. In association with Hot Docs Partners. A Spring Films and Werner Herzog film production. A title appears. Fireball, Visitors from Darker Worlds. A film by Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer. At night, a crowd watches performers in skeleton body paint and feathered headdresses surrounding a fireball on a stand. Words appear. Merida, Mexico, Day of the Dead.
Merida on the Yucatan Peninsula is ground zero of the biggest cataclysm that ever occurred to our planet. A whole asteroid hit right here. This happened millions of years before human beings appeared. And yet this fireball ritual feels like a reenactment. Certainly, the ancient Mayas could not have known.
The performers toss the fireball around. Daytime, Chelyabinsk, Siberia.
We do not know what in the future is coming at us, eventually destroying us. But it will look like this fireball over Siberia, only much larger.
A meteor sails overhead.
What simple dashboard cameras recorded feels like science fiction.
The meteor leaves an orange flare as it shoots downward across the sky. The light shines blindingly bright over cars driving on roads below, then flashes red. On another street, the glimmering light conceals buildings, then glows on a snow-covered park. Shadows from statues in the park turn as the meteor passes over it. An orb of light around the meteor brightens, then dims as it barrels toward the horizon of a rural, snowy landscape.
Visitors from other worlds, from the dark of the universe, have come, and untold numbers are still on their way.
Wolf Creek Crater, Western Australia.
If something big is going to happen, it will illuminate the sky even in daylight. But that may be millions of years away.
Flat desert stretches out from a huge crater.
Meteorites have hit our planet all the time, and the bigger ones have changed entire landscapes. But they also have left a deep impact on cultures. A good example is Islamic culture. According to ancient tradition, a stone was sent down by God from heaven as a guide for Adam and Eve where to build an altar. The meteorite came down where later the holy city of Mecca was built.
Thousands of people fill an enormous outdoor mosque, Mecca, Saudi Arabia.
We are here at the holiest site of the Muslim world. In its center, the Kaaba. Embedded in its eastern corner, the Black Stone. It was already venerated in pre-Islamic times for at least a millennium before the Prophet Muhammad founded Islam.
Worshippers encircle the Kaaba.
The Black Stone is framed entirely in silver, and nobody is allowed to analyze it, but it is almost certainly a meteorite.
Black stone shows through an oval opening in the silver.
Islam is a religion of 1.9 billion faithful. For the pilgrims, the black stone is among the most revered of relics. It attracts uncountable millions of touches and kisses.
Worshippers crowd the opening.
As non-Muslims, we are not allowed even to set foot into the holy city. And so we had to rely on cell phone footage of one of the faithful.
At the Kaaba, men push against each other and reach over each other to place their hands on the stone through the silver opening. An armed guard stands beside it. A man places his head in the hole and kisses the black stone. In Australia, the circular Wolf Creek crater stands out on the barren landscape.
Back in the silent vastness of the Australian desert.
Its rim casts a shadow inside it.
Clive Oppenheimer of Cambridge University, who started our voyage of this film, explains to me.
On the rim.
Scientists only became aware of this huge hole in the ground in 1947, when it was spotted from the air. And the crater is about a kilometer across. And it was formed when a piece of iron asteroid, the size of a battleship and traveling at 15 kilometers per second, plummeted into the ground. And the crater walls around the floor here are made of the ancient rocks that were shattered by the impact and thrown about. The meteoroid itself was almost completely vaporized, and only a few fragments of it have been found scattered across the surrounding desert. The pattern of ejecta suggests that the bolide came from that direction over there. The temperatures are so phenomenal that it generates a huge thermal plume that punches up through the atmosphere into the stratosphere, and it's raining out molten debris over a very wide area. And of course, there's colossal seismic energy that is generated by the impact itself. So huge earthquakes. I mean, we're in the middle of the desert here, but if you imagine this scenario happening today in an urban environment, this would be absolutely devastating.
To be hit by a meteorite has barely ever happened.
There was a woman who was struck by a meteorite that came through her roof, through her ceiling, and hit her while she was seated in an armchair watching TV, the Sylacauga meteorite. She survived it, but had a pretty horrific bruise.
A photo shows a woman lying in bed with a large bruise on her midsection at Wolf Creek Crater.
As bleak and uninviting the country around the crater looks, there were always Aboriginal people in this area. Many of them make a living as artists, like those in the nearest community of Bililuna. They could not have witnessed the impact more than 100,000 years ago, but there were more recent events that could have triggered a cultural memory. In their paintings, the crater frequently appears as a motif, but it goes deeper than that.
A woman paints in a studio.
We met Katie Darkey, one of the finest artists of the community.
This is one of your very own paintings,
yes,
isn't it? Let's have a look at this one.
Clive unrolls a painting of bright dots around concentric circles.
Yeah, please tell us what we're looking at here. It's a beautiful painting.
This is the sandhill. And this is the grass. And it haven't got any Gandhi, no potatoes. Long time ago, the old people said, the one man went hunting through the creeks, hunting for birds, but he was walking through the tunnel underneath the river, but we call it a creek, and it came out on the other side of the crater and then went walking back to where he came from when he was hunting.
And in this story, the crater, how was it formed? What's the origin?
Well, in Gadia world, there's a meteorite fell in there.
That's our story,
the white fella stories. Some say it's a star fell in there. But the ancestors and the old people were telling us it's the rainbow serpent who fell in the crater. So that's how we got three different stories about the crater, but it connected in one. We always take the kids. Every weekend we come and camp at the, and that's where we feel the presence of our ancestors and our family, that they are looking after us when we go down and visit the crater. It's a very special place for us, for our families as well.
In an art gallery, Katie Darkey, an artist with graying hair, looks up from her painting, unmoving as a fly lands on her face and flits around her. At the teardrop-shaped center of Wolf Creek Crater, vegetation grows around the perimeter and in patches. Dark reddish-brown dirt surrounds the crater's center and reaches to the steeply inclined crater rim. Fade to black. Elsewhere, clouds fill a gray sky. Thin trees with bright green leaves blow in a mild breeze.
Meteorites have fallen at random, a significant one in the Alsace region of France. But right here, it changed human affairs, it influenced history.
Between two trees, a black stone rests on top of a post with a plaque next to it. A dirt road runs along an expansive cornfield. A town rests beyond farmland and thick trees, with mountains in the distance. Words appear: Enzisheim, Alsace, France.
In the distance, the town of Enzisheim. In the 15th century, world history was shaped here because the Habsburg Empire earned legitimacy through a falling piece of rock. The plaque marks a spot where it fell.
A man in glasses stands between the plaque and the rock.
Clive brought Professor Simon Schaffer, a colleague from Cambridge University. He is a historian of science and one of the few remaining polymaths.
What happened on that day in 7th of November 1492?
So, on this extraordinary day, a fireball appeared in the southeast sky, in that direction, moving incredibly fast and whistling as it came. And then it hit this field at about 11:30 in the morning. There was, according to most reports, just one person standing in the field, a shepherd boy, and he would have seen the most extraordinary thing. He would have seen a 300-pound rock hit the field and gouge out a hole. The 7th of November 1492, the moment when this stone fell, was only a few days after another great landfall, the arrival of Christopher Columbus and his crew in their new world in the Caribbean. It's thanks to Columbus, ultimately, that there is corn growing in this field. This is the result of the eruption into European agriculture of crops that up till then had only grown in the Americas. Indeed, the fall of the stone was so important that there are some chronicles covering the year 1492 that only mention the Enzisheim stone and simply leave Columbus out. It had fallen, perhaps by divine design, as they thought, very near an extremely significant town, Enzisheim, in Alsace. Enzisheim, at that point, was the headquarters of the Austrian forces in this part of the world. And within 2 weeks of the arrival of the stone, the Austrian military commander, the commander-in-chief, Maximilian, also arrived in the town.
But for heaven's sake, why did this stone fall here at this time?
The reason this stone fell in this field was exactly for heaven's sake. For those people, wonderful supernatural signs in the heavens were messages. This was, as it were, an email sent from God to the subjects of Maximilian to tell them that his rule was legitimate, that he would defeat his enemies, and that they should obey his commands.
Where do you get your fascination from?
I think one of the things that I find completely obsessional about meteorites is that they carry sense, that they carry meaning. They arrive, so it was thought, with other kinds of falls, with body parts and frogs and rains of blood, with plagues and other catastrophes. Something like a meteorite is an organism, an animal almost, that speaks to us. And I think that's a very powerful and eloquent idea. The idea that meteorites have meaning, and the task of humanity is to interpret what that meaning is.
In a museum.
Simon Schaffer could have continued without getting boring non-stop for the next 8 hours. But we wanted to see the remains of the real stone in the local museum. It feels unreal, inviting fantasies.
A meteorite rests in a case.
The mayor of town wanted to greet us here, flanked by friends of the meteorite. This emblem is taken from a medieval woodcut. You find it everywhere. But today, it means thinking back and thinking ahead in centuries. Did these members of the Brotherhood of the Stone have a far-off future in mind? What are they thinking? What far-reaching plans do they have?
Three men smile.
What if the human race became extinct? What would we leave for future astronauts of an alien galaxy to demonstrate that we would not leave a fallen comrade behind? Right next to the stone, we discovered this installation.
Footage projects near a bust.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Jean, je suis un ancien mineur.
Hi, my name is John, says the simulacrum. Hoping the aliens speak French, I am a miner. And this is how beautiful our world looked.
Photos show the town.
When danger for our planet became visible in the night sky, we took precautions. We dug tunnels and built shelters underground. We think we have a chance to survive a whole decade. If a big firestorm comes, I'm confident the human race can survive it. But I'm not a prophet, I'm just a miner.
En attendant, je vous souhaite une bonne fin de visite.
I wish you a good end to your visit.
The color projected on the bust fades, leaving the miner's frowning, bearded face in black and white. The projected light turns off, casting the bust in darkness. Words on a building with an arched roof read Valhall Arena.
Next destination, the big sports arena in Oslo, Norway. It is so spacious that it houses an entire football field. But we were interested in its roof, and we were interested in this man, Jon Larsen, Norway's most famous jazz musician. But it is as a citizen scientist that he has every reason to be on this big roof.
The gray-haired Jon Larsen plays a guitar on a flat part of the arena's roof. Later, he crosses the roof with Clive.
How did this all start? How did you find this place?
I searched on Google Earth and found the largest roof that I could see. And this sports arena was probably the largest in Oslo at that time. And then I realized the small object will roll down the side and accumulate along here and end up close to the drain. And as we can see, there is a lot of dirt here, but within we will find the cosmic dust particles.
How did you get started? You've had 4 decades long career as a successful musician. Why have you ended up on rooftops? Was it to escape your fans?
No. I've always collected rock and been interested in geology, and that has been my hobby all my life. So 10 years ago, when suddenly on the breakfast table one morning, outdoors, I discovered a shining black dot on my table, which hadn't been there 2 seconds earlier. And I picked it up on my finger, and because of my background as an amateur mineralogist, I could see, wow, this is actually a small rock. And I realized, where did it come from? Is it from space, perhaps? I don't know. But then I started to Google and found out that there are some strange small cosmic dust particles called micrometeorites. And then it all began.
And you think there are some here. What's the equipment that you need to collect this goop?
My main weapon is this magnet. And I use the magnet mainly because the micrometeorites are magnetic. First, I put the magnet itself into a just protecting small Ziploc plastic bag, like this. And then the hook is handy, literally.
It is astounding that Jon Larsen, with such primitive equipment, has founded a completely new branch of science.
And now this will be the sampling area. I will move it down on the ground like this. Heavy particles will roll down and remain at the heaviest part. This might be some microscopic magnetic particles, and look at it later under the microscope.
What's the flux of these cosmic particles to the Earth per day? Do we know the figure?
Yeah, approximately 100 metric tons. Imagine two large trucks of sand pouring cosmic dust over Earth every day, but that equals one small particle per year. Per square meter.
These particles are messengers, aren't they? This seemed to be a very particular message for you.
Yeah, to me it is, and they are the oldest matter there is. Nothing has traveled further. When I pick out one micrometeorite and feel it on my finger, no human being have ever touched anything older. I mean, it's really looking the eternity in the white in the eye. This is the ashes of another generation, previous generation of dying stars. So it has a history that goes all the way back to the Big Bang.
A tall man wears a cowboy hat.
This is Jan Braley Keele, a geologist who will analyze Jon's samples under the microscope. We loved his outfit as Wyatt Earp. He was born in Texas. But there's more to him. He's a four-time cancer survivor, two times, according to him, stark naked death sentences. Wanting to contribute to cancer research, he's now involved in pioneering work with new cancer treatments.
This is the underworld. This is where we try to make the photographical documentation. This is Jan Keele, my friend. We have worked together for years to make high-resolution color photographs of the micrometeorites at such a magnification that it's made nowhere else in the world.
How much magnification do you need?
You can see these particles are so small, it's practically not possible to see them. We need 2,000 or better, 3,000 times magnification, and then the original photo will be 1 meter in diameter. That's what we need.
You know, when everybody says this was impossible, now we made it. Completely new kind of science. And you recall the kind of feedback we got from colleagues. Yes. They were laughing hilarious.
Oh, yes.
When they asked us, what are you going to do? What? Everybody knows that that's impossible. You know, this Hilton noise ratio is beyond 1 to 1 billion. Make my day. Did it hurt you that time?
Of course not. This is how science works. It has nothing to do with feelings. It's just about curiosity.
So this is from earlier today?
When we see that special type of texture, then we know, okay, this is a micrometeorite and not an industrial particle.
And it's obviously quite blurred at the moment. Can we take a photograph of it?
No. If we just, our heartbeat, when we get too enthusiastic, we'll make disturbances, so it's not possible. We'll have to leave the room when we actually take the photos.
Where would these particles come from in the first place?
Oh, that's a good question, because we don't know the answer. They come, obviously, from space. So some of them are from the asteroid belt. Others may come from cometary matter. But again, it might be particles from other galaxies, other solar systems. We don't know the parent body of each individual grain.
That's just amazing, each Tuesday night when Jon brings in new material and then we're just flabbergasted. It's like being a kid again.
These particles are small and solitary also in space. Some of them have never reached the larger scale of, let's say, starting to build small planets as in the asteroid belt. It's actually cosmic dust. Dust is the currency of the cosmos.
Here on the top, you have, for instance, this is iron and nickel alloy.
A photo of a particle.
And here have a very nice beginning of crystallization. Started out with just a glass. But now we start to crystallize olivine crystals. And this outside is a very, very thin rim of iron sulfides.
This looks like almost sort of an icy
exoplanet.
The icebergs breaking up.
This one, I think, is particularly interesting. It has had a very high temperature at the atmospheric entry in the front, which is up. That is the direction of movement in the Earth's atmosphere. Then when it starts to decelerate, the heavy metal core is pushed forward by the inertia and ends up like a metal mound in the front of the particle.
Again, the typical with the iron nickel in front. So, I mean, though we have collected now 2,500 different specimens, none are identical.
So when you start to get to know the micrometeorites and the cosmic dust particles, then you will recognize them as very different from the terrestrial geology. They have been through a process with speed, you know, hypervelocity, 50 times the speed of a rifle bullet, and temperatures from hell, and then they end up like treasures from space.
High-definition color photos show different microscopic particles. The first shows a golden-yellow particle with small splotches of a dark iridescent mineral on it. The second shows a nearly black particle with light gray lines on it. The third shows a particle with a black circle near the center, surrounded by a neon pink and green band, wrapped in a tan outer material with a bright yellow bulge on one side. More photos show rounded particles in bright and dull colors, ending with a gray particle shaped like a blooming flower with a golden orb at its center. A green splotch is projected on a chalkboard.
The beauty and strangeness that we just saw can become even stranger.
This is what the pattern looks like. If you hold it down, I'll go up front and to the board.
The pattern that Clive is projecting here is proof of something that was believed to be unthinkable. It has to do with matter of crystalline structure that seemed to be utterly impossible, so-called quasi-crystals. This is the man who refused to accept the impossibility. He's a world-renowned cosmologist, Paul Steinhardt of Princeton University.
You ended up finding evidence of a quasi-crystal, a natural quasi-crystal from the universe found in a meteorite. But, I mean, what is a quasi-crystal?
So a quasi-crystal is a form of matter that we thought was impossible for hundreds of years. We were convinced that we had proven that it was impossible. But as we now know today, not only is it possible, but it was made in the universe long ago, long before we ever imagined. But let's begin with something simple.
Crystals follow a pattern of order, like the tiling of your bathroom floor.
Paul and Clive arrange tiles on a paper.
Square tiles fit seamlessly, but with pentagons, a five-fold symmetry, you are quickly in trouble.
Let's go out this way a little bit.
Clive lines up pentagon-shaped tiles.
I can already see where the problem's going to come from.
Yeah, see what's happening? We opened up a gap, so now we have some choices to make. We're not going to be able to fill that in.
I could either put it there or there, but there's never going to be a way to...
Yeah.
He adjusts them.
Atoms hate having gaps. So the moment you produce gaps with real atoms, they're going to move around and get rid of them. Bifold symmetry was famously forbidden for matter.
But quasi-crystals are even more complex and mysterious than this.
Let's just take a look at a quasi-crystal pattern first to get a visual impression of what they're like. So a good example is this tiling that you see on the table. If you study it, you'll see it's made of only two pieces, two shapes.
The chickens.
This looks like a puzzle for children, but there is ingenious mathematics behind it.
This pattern was discovered by Sir Roger Penrose in the 1970s. A mathematician and sometimes a cosmologist as well.
It is astonishing that a quasi-crystal pattern can be found in a shrine in Isfahan in Iran. Without any knowledge of the underlying mathematical principles, artisans more than 500 years ago solve the impossible geometry of fivefold symmetry.
There we go.
Clive fits the tiles together.
Now, I should warn you.
The warning was justified. Yes, indeed, it gets so complicated now that we are not going to torture you with details. Just a sample.
So instead of just one icosahedron, we have an icosahedron of icosahedra. And we said, oh, maybe that's a way of building something ever outwards that maintains the structure. But we ran into trouble.
But this model here solved the problem. It represents a true quasi-crystal.
And you could only just build this plane. But
now, Steinhardt wanted to find one in nature.
Started here to build. You ended up in doing field work in Kamchatka, and there must have been inspired jump from by theoretical. Inspired by this model, because what this model says, well, actually, if the atoms have forces that are like these interlocks, they have no choice but to form this structure. It immediately got me to thinking. Is it possible that nature has made a quasicrystal before humans did? And so that began a decades-long search for a natural quasicrystal. We eventually found a mineralogist in Florence named Luca Bindi, who had in his museum a tiny little sample of, well, a rock, a complex rock, which had inside it a little grain of quasicrystal. By studying that particular sample, we had some hints that what we had in hand was a piece of a meteorite. But to prove the case, we had to find out where that rock really came from and see if we could gather more of the sample to prove the case.
So Paul Steinhardt and Luca Bindi set out on an expedition to easternmost Russia, close to the Bering Strait.
A red dot glows near the coast.
The red marker shows the site of the meteorite fragments. They were found along a creek named Listvenitjovi, of which nobody has ever heard. The expedition included members of the original Russian geological team that had found the first sample decades ago.
At a river, a red all-terrain bus slowly eases over the inclined edge of the shoreline and falls into the water. It drives across the river.
They had to negotiate uncharted terrain, totally novel for Paul Steinhardt, whose outdoor experience did not extend beyond the lawns of Princeton University.
The bus mows down thick brush and leafy trees as its track wheels power over them.
Myriads of mosquitoes tormented him. Here we see him with a mosquito net over his face. His sleep was fitful. Bears not only appeared in his nightmares, they were really out there. The hard work to find fragments of the meteorite paid off. First inspection of their findings looked promising. Now, Bindi and Steinhardt had reason to celebrate, although they could not yet know if quasi-crystals were present.
In Paul's office.
The X-ray diffraction pattern of the newly found samples revealed the forbidden five-fold symmetry, proof there were quasi-crystals within the meteorite.
Could you describe your emotion when you saw this? I think everything, time seemed to stop for me at that moment. It's just seeing this image just told me immediately that everything we'd been trying to achieve for decades had now been achieved. Plus, we had verified that this quasicrystal not only was formed in nature, but had been formed in space.
Leaving the arcane mysteries of matter behind, we turned towards the more average rocks that had come down upon us.
We have some sticky mat here.
A man peels a mat.
Arizona State University houses a large collection.
This dirt that we have from outside going into the clean vault.
But wild stories were waiting for us.
So when we go in, make sure you just step on there to get the dirt off your feet.
All right.
Lawrence Garvey, its curator, guided us.
We have a positive pressure in here.
Yep.
Just to keep sort of clean air coming in. Got the feet, got the dirt off. Oh,
yep.
Good. And we were also on camera all the time. Go smile to the camera, wave to the camera. Hey. But really what's important here is that when we're in a meteorite facility like this is to keep the meteorites as clean as possible. You know, usually we think of trying to keep ourselves clean. Here we're trying to keep the grease from our fingers off the samples. So can you please wear some gloves, and I'll put some gloves on as well. And we're doing this because I want to show you one of the most spectacular meteorites that only fell a few weeks ago, and actually fell in Costa Rica. And it's a meteorite that's full of organic compounds. And you know, and that's important because that tells us about our early solar system and possibly the formation of life in our solar system as well. Now, I actually have the samples here in these special cabinets. These are nitrogen cabinets, right? So we have nitrogen, dry nitrogen. Here's what's important, dry nitrogen being fed into the cabinets. So when I open it, you can actually hear the nitrogen being fed into the cabinets. And these meteorites are now preserved. We don't have water going on to them. We don't have oxygen going on to them. So it's the best preservation that we currently have.
That's what the hissing is.
That's what the hissing is.
Lawrence opens a cabinet.
So to give an example, here is...
He removes a sample.
One of the most amazing meteorites to ever. See what it's called? The Doghouse. So let's just...
He takes a black chunk of stone from a plastic case.
So, I have to ask, do not drop this. I'll try not. Please don't drop it.
He places it in Clive's gloved hands.
So this stone actually fell only a few weeks ago in Costa Rica, and this one actually fell through a doghouse with the dog that was still sleeping in it.
The dog was unharmed.
It missed the dog by millimeters and it embedded itself in the ground right next to the dog. So what makes this one special as well, it's actually got some dog hair still stuck to it.
No way.
And what makes this one so amazing is the fact that if you smell it...
Clive sniffs.
You can actually smell the organic compounds that are in here. These are 4.5 billion-year-old compounds that were formed on an early planet. That planet no longer exists and got trapped in this stone and basically just resided in the asteroid belt for 4 billion years before, for some reason, it left the asteroid belt and landed in Costa Rica and is now in our meteorite vault here.
What is that smell? Is this what...
We don't actually know, but we think it's similar like mothballs. Something similar to that compound.
Like a solvent or something?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm actually going to put this one back unless you want to hold it again.
No.
So why, by the way, the red is from the roof of the doghouse, and the white is from the floor of the doghouse.
And did the dog instantly realise that it had received a visitor from the heavens?
Well, it didn't, but funny enough, people have used dogs to look for meteorites because of the smell. They can be trained to find that smell. Let's put this back now.
Lawrence gently places the meteorite in its case and sets it on the cabinet shelf.
Well, this is the Toluca iron from the Chicopilco region. Here, try this one. Don't drop it on your toe, it'll break.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry, I mean, that must weigh what? 30 kilos, 40 kilos, just that one stone?
That's just pure iron.
That's just pure iron, but nickel-rich iron. Here, let's not drop it.
Ready?
Lawrence sets it down.
You know, one of the most amazing impact phenomena I've never seen on TV is this material, tektites. Now, here we have, there was an impact on the Earth that basically melted large amounts of the Earth's surface. In this case, probably several thousand square kilometers of ground. It was almost instantaneously melted. And then the shock from that impact then sprayed this material over about a third of the Earth.
When did this happen?
We've dated about 750,000 years ago. So, you know, sounds like a long time ago, but from a geological time period, it's actually just yesterday. It's a very recent phenomenon.
It's glass.
This is just, so what this stuff is, if you listen, this is just glass, but this is not extraterrestrial glass. This is the Earth of which you had all this material melted, just turned into a melt, and then sprayed over the Earth. And so you find this material in Southeast Asia, Philippines, through Indonesia, all the way down through Australia, and then all the way down into Antarctica. And so this was a humongous event. Look at the shapes, though. You know what these shapes are telling us? This is telling us that this stuff was sprayed and then solidified in the air.
If we'd been there when this thing came down, I mean, what that would have been the end of us.
Oh, I mean, everything. Imagine, and I mean, several thousand square kilometers. Everything underneath that was almost instantly turned to glass. So, yes, you'd be sitting there having your cup of tea, be turned to glass. everything.
A meteorite's metallic surface shines through its darker blotches.
Each one of these stones from darker worlds out there has its own story.
Inside a meteorite cut in half, brown spots dot the flat gray and white rock. The inside of another shows green glassy crystals between the gray rock.
Throughout history, meteorites have captivated human imagination. A tool as simple as a light from a cell phone extols the mysterious beauty of these voyages from afar.
A gloved hand grips a slab of crystal-encrusted meteorite. Another hand holds a cell phone flashlight behind it. As the hand moves, the light shines through the crystals on the slab, turning them a glowing gold color. Later, Clive walks past a lab next to a woman with long brown hair and bangs.
What we have here at the same Center for Meteorite Studies in Tempe, Arizona, we met Dr. Meenakshi Wadhwa, one of the foremost scientists of meteorites.
40,000 different meteorites?
Including a piece by Barbara Hepworth.
Exactly. These are an incredible resource for all of the work that we do here.
What are we looking at here?
So that round object that you're seeing, that is a tiny little, you can imagine it as a tiny little droplet that was present in the earliest history of the solar system, something like 4.5 billion years ago.
Is this before the planets have accreted?
Yes, so this is when there was just gas and dust, nothing else. There were no planets, there was no Earth, nothing. And these have been described as droplets of fiery rain that were just condensing out of that nebula, that cloud of gas and dust. Probably because of some sort of shock processes that were happening in the earliest history of our solar system. And we don't really know actually where those shocks were coming from, but we think those are the kinds of processes that were happening in, you know, other solar systems that are forming today.
What elements do we find in there?
Yeah, so what you're seeing, you know, this kind of beautiful stained glass pattern that you're seeing, that's a mineral called olivine. And this kind of, when I rotate it in this, as you have this sort of transmitted light going through these minerals, you are polarized, the light is polarized, and so the mineral itself is sort of extinguishing the light in certain directions. And so you're kind of seeing this brightening and then darkening. And it's like a beautiful stained glass window, really. I think it's kind of...
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Here is a slice, a thin slice of the very Mars sample that I first looked at the very start of my career studying meteorites. And I was just fascinated because, you know, it looked so familiar, but it came from a completely different world. We know that this rock came from Mars because it has gases trapped in it that have the exact same composition as the Martian atmosphere. And so when you take a piece of this rock and you heat it up, you release these gases, and you can measure the composition of that gas, and it's the exact composition as what we measured using these spacecraft on Mars. It's incredible.
As the microscope sample turns, rainbow iridescent minerals among black shining minerals change from blue and purple to a green, yellow, and back again. Another microscopic sample shows a sky blue circle with line fragments cutting across it, and clusters of minerals in varying shades of glimmering blue and gold scattered along a black surface.
It was Carl Sagan right that we're made of that stardust.
We are all stardust, absolutely. I mean, every element in our body was synthesized in other stars before it got here. So yeah, we're all stardust, eventually.
A wonderful
film. Yeah.
This was the only time throughout the entire shooting of this film where I could not resist. I had to intervene from behind the camera.
I think not stardust, I'm Bavarian.
Yeah, that's made of special stuff, that is.
That's right.
Meenakshi grins. Elsewhere, four columns between arches mark the edge of a stone balcony overlooking a valley and mountains.
Our voyage took us to wherever large fireballs had plunged down to Earth. We wanted to know if life had come from outer space. This is Ramgarh Crater in Rajasthan in northern India, 4 kilometers across. From space, it immediately catches the eye, but down on the ground, you barely notice you are inside a crater. However, Hindu temples were built here since the 10th century. We were curious if organic matter in meteorites could have provided the ingredients of life on our planet. We were seeking the expertise of Professor Nita Sahai, who studies the transition from chemistry to biology.
And we're in this huge crater here formed by a meteorite impact, and we don't know whether it was a carbonaceous one, but we know that these carbonaceous meteorites have all kinds of organic molecules in them. Mm-hmm. What are the key ones that might represent building blocks of life?
Actually, all of the building blocks of life have been found in meteorites. Amino acids that make up proteins, lipid molecules that make up cell membranes, and amazingly, even ribose, which is a sugar.
I just find it astonishing, you know, that you can find sugars and things that make proteins in a meteorite.
Right.
I mean, are they made geologically, like minerals, or?
Yeah, they're not like minerals in the sense that they're organic molecules and minerals are inorganic, but they have been formed presumably by the interactions of organic molecules with mineral surfaces, for example, on interstellar grains, as well as on the surfaces of the meteorites themselves.
And I mean, there's still a big step from having these ingredients to sparking life.
And right.
What do we need? I guess we need some kind of crucible to put this stuff in and a heat source.
Yeah. So you need to get these simple building blocks polymerized into longer chains, because the longer chains have the ability to fold and be functional.
What do you think of the idea of panspermia, that life is dispersed around the universe? I mean, is it conceivable that living organisms could survive the intense temperatures and radiation of outer space?
DNA has actually been found to be quite robust, and it's possible to survive in space. And even an entire organism might survive in a spore-like mode, because people have actually dug deep into the earth, and even a couple of kilometers down, they find bacteria that have been living there presumably for millions of years, and they survive in this state of kind of suspended animation.
Do you have any idea why the priests built their temples here? I mean, this one's dedicated to Shiva, you know.
Right.
I mean, it seems too good to be true on the floor of a meteorite impact crater.
It's kind of interesting that this temple is dedicated to Shiva and Parvati, and it's a tantric temple, which represents creation. And Shiva is also the god of destruction. So in Hindu mythology, there is this idea of cycles of creation and destruction of the universe, and appropriately, it's in a meteor impact crater site where the impact can wipe out life, but then also deliver these organic molecules that could have seeded life in the first place.
A man with a turban and a white beard stands near a lake.
This was confirmed in a similar way by a resident sadhu. If humanity and all life becomes extinct by war or a meteorite, life will regenerate at this place, at this crater lake.
With his palms placed together at his face, the man bows his head. A fireball catapults through space.
We had to go where the most colossal fireball came down. It was at a place with an unpronounceable name at the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico.
At a gulfside boardwalk.
This is the very place where our planet suffered an unimaginable apocalypse. What came down from space right here had the force of hundreds of millions, possibly thousands of millions, of atomic bombs Hiroshima size. Nothing out here is reminiscent of it. Only leaden boredom weighs upon everything.
A bird perches on a lamppost.
Chicxulub is a beach resort so godforsaken you want to cry.
On a small rocky beach, boats wait clustered near the edge of a crumbling sidewalk leading to a brightly painted blue shack. A broken cement wall lines the sidewalk along the road leading away from the beach. Bars cover the windows of a light pink, water-damaged building. A chain-link fence closes in the remains of a decaying structure. On another street, white shirts hang on a laundry line outside a modest cream-colored house, with women seated at an outdoor table beneath an awning. Decaying flat-roofed buildings cramp the street. Green palm fronds wave above telephone lines. On the sidewalk, two dogs lounge beside a puddle. On another street, piles of construction rubble, plywood, and gravel wait outside an unpainted concrete building. A tarp hangs on another partially constructed building, with rebar sticking up from the roof and a truck parked out front. At one end of an intersection, two dogs sniff another dog's body that lies still in the street.
The dogs here, like all dogs on this planet, are just too dim-witted to understand that three-quarters of all species were extinguished by the event that took place right here.
A Triceratops statue stands roped off in a museum exhibit.
Dinosaurs have only survived in a local museum. Their eyes were made by humans. They recognize nothing. Only their footprints are authentic, but they show they were ambling along, not fleeing. They were oblivious to the sudden death of everything.
Claw-toed footprints mark a stone walkway leading toward the boardwalk. Clive strides along it, stopping in front of a sign with an anchor below it that reads, Chicxulub, Puerto, Mexico.
This godforsaken spot is at the center of one of the greatest geological cataclysms in Earth history. It irreversibly changed the course of life on the planet. Some 66 million years ago, an asteroid perhaps 10 kilometers across came hurtling to the Earth at speeds of 20 kilometers a second. That the force of the impact was so phenomenal that it excavated a hole 30 kilometers deep. The crater that formed stretches out 100 kilometers out to sea and 100 kilometers inland. And the temperatures generated in the crust from the impact melted and vaporized the crust and the bolide itself. There were earthquakes of magnitude 11. That's 100 times greater than any historical earthquake. Mega tsunami, 100 meter high waves, ravaged the shorelines of distant oceans. And a vast pool of dust and molten droplets and gases soared into the atmosphere, some of the material even reaching escape velocity and exiting into space. Those molten droplets rained out over an area of 3,000 kilometers, igniting firestorms on the land.
I love how movies depict it.
800 kilometers from the impact site, the light is so intense, it causes the flesh of the Alamosaurus to appear transparent.
Last Day of the Dinosaurs, 2010.
And burns images of their shadows onto the ground.
Dinosaurs watch a distant explosion.
The scorching light sears their eyeballs. They now can't see what's headed their way. But they can feel it.
The mammals, they made it through and they took advantage of the new ecological opportunities. We probably wouldn't be here ourselves, Homo sapiens as a species, were it not for this colossal impact.
Nobody knew there is an impact crater until the 1970s. Gravity anomalies and borehole data revealed its structure and immense size. The only surface manifestation is an enigmatic ring of waterholes called cenotes. They are a geological echo of the impact. Since there are no rivers and lakes in the Yucatan Peninsula, these waterholes attracted the ancient Mayas. Without the presence of cenotes, this cultural center of Chichen Itza would never have been built.
A pyramid temple stands.
They developed a high culture with a writing system, astronomy, and monumental architecture of pyramids and temples.
Stacked terraces form the stone pyramid. A straight, wide staircase leads up to a box-shaped edifice at the top.
They even built an observatory before there were telescopes. They tracked the position of celestial bodies. Their calendar was much more precise than anything at this historical time. The Mayas had a deep fascination of death and the afterlife. In their belief, there were 9 underworlds and 13 heavens.
In a wooded area, Clive and a group of people traverse a rocky slope.
Wanting to see some of the underworld, we descended to the bottom of a nearby cenote.
A calm pool of water waits at the bottom of the slope.
Fatima Tek Paul, a cave expert and archaeologist, took us to one of the abodes of the rain god.
Fatima wears a helmet with a headlamp.
This cenote was virtually unknown until very recently. Tell me, Fatima, what is the relationship between the cenote, the cave here, and the ritual and belief of the Maya?
Subtitles appear. This place is interesting because you can see how the concepts of water and caves combine, and how the Mayans use these spaces for rituals. Inside, you can see walls which suggest the Mayans used to make pilgrimages here to pass through these sacred walls. Can we go in? Of course, let's go. Clive and 3 other people with helmets and headlamps trail Fatima into a cave beneath a rock overhang. As the caves are seen as entrances to the underworld, we can see here how they made use of the natural form of the cave to make ritual deposits of human remains, possibly an ancestor of a Mayan family. What era are they from? Possibly the pre-classic. We can also see this portal. This takes us further into the underworld. There's something else interesting. Fatima and Clive step up to a rock wall in the cave with a small built-in doorway. A human finger bone. Deposited here in part of the wall, look closely and you can see ashes, possibly a kind of mortuary treatment before being placed in the wall.
Is it safe for human beings to enter the underworld, the abode of the gods?
Yes, of course. Holding a flashlight, Clive kneels in front of the small doorway and points his light down the short tunnel leading into a rocky cavern beyond. Outside, at a Mayan ruin, a stone wall is engraved with human skulls.
We timed our visit with the Mexican Day of the Dead. For the Mayans, death was an obsession. There are endless friezes with nothing but skulls.
In the wall, the skulls are carved in profile, facing to the right, each shaped slightly differently from the others. On a street at night, a crowd of children wear skull face paint and hold candles.
Merida, the central cemetery. All this within the perimeter of the Chicxulub crater.
A little girl wears a red scarf.
The dead leave their graves and join the living.
A wide-brimmed straw hat adorns the head of a boy waiting in the crowd. Black paint circles his eyes, covers the tip of his nose and the area beneath his cheekbones. Vertical black lines mark his mouth. A girl standing near him wears a similar skull makeup and 3 flowers on the side of her head. Her skin is shaded with white and brown paint, and her hairline is marked with a thick black line. Shadows move over the grim, painted face of a smaller boy with a straw hat on his head and a red handkerchief tied around his neck. More children with skull faces and candles wait behind them. A crowd of watching adults hold up their cell phones. A procession slowly marches past them, featuring adults wearing skull face paint and carrying candles encased in clear cups. Candlelight flickers on the face of a grave young man in detailed skull face paint. He wears a white shirt and straw hat with a red handkerchief tied at the base of his throat. He slowly walks forward with the procession. Men, women, and children wearing face paint and traditional dress follow behind him. Some walk along in street clothes without makeup. Women wear flower-patterned white dresses, skull face paint, marigolds in their hair, and red scarves around their faces and necks. Men wear similar costumes. Flowing white streamer decorations on poles stick up from the packed parade as it inches down a street toward a brightly lit archway. Elsewhere during the day, trees line a narrow paved road. The sun shines through their spindly branches and green leaves, speckling light on the pavement. Words appear. Park of Castel Gandolfo, summer residence of the Pope.
We are here in the serene park of the Pope's summer residence of Castel Gandolfo. However, serious science is being done here. There's an astronomical observatory famous for its photographic celestial map. Right next to the residence, Lake Albano, a formidable volcanic crater.
Water fills the crater.
The director of the observatory is a Jesuit, Brother Guy Consolmagno. He's one of the foremost scholars in meteoritics.
Brother Guy, at the heart of the Vatican Observatory is this wonderful meteorite collection, quite a historical collection.
I certainly think so. This is the stuff I've been working on for now nearly 30 years.
Is this why you came here initially?
I didn't choose to come here. I did this under a vow of obedience. I had been a scientist and then entered the Jesuits and thought I was going to be teaching at a school like maybe Georgetown. But under obedience, they ordered me to come to Rome and eat that terrible food and look at this miserable scenery. And oh yes, there's a collection of 1,000 meteorites. They didn't know that the meteorites were here. They didn't know that my expertise was meteorites. It was one of those divine coincidences. It's phenomenal that we've got meteorites, that we've got pieces of outer space that have visited us here on Earth, and that we can tell that they're not from the Earth, that they're made chemically of completely different materials, that they were formed 4.5 billion years ago, that we have the ability to understand these things is itself a miracle.
And you would find it perfectly reasonable that life is elsewhere in the universe. Life on Earth may have originated elsewhere.
It's possible. I don't know. I don't have the data. You know, people will sometimes ask me, do I believe that there's life elsewhere in the universe? And I think that's the right way to ask it. It's a matter of belief. I don't have the data. But if you were to come to me as a scientist saying you wanted resources to look for life and you had a great project, I'd say, go for it. On the other hand, if you were saying you wanted to study, you know, little green men coming out of a flying saucer, then I'm not so sure I'd go along with that.
But if the green men arrived on Earth, would you consider baptizing them?
Only if they ask.
Clive nods.
Brother Guy invited us to see the historical telescope.
They were commissioned to photograph the entire sky and make a photographic atlas.
Why throughout so much of history and around the world have people thought of heaven as up there?
I don't know, but it's certainly true. I mean, there are so many languages where the word for sky and the word for heaven are the same word. All I can think of, and maybe, you know, a professional would come up with a better answer, all I could think of is looking at the stars give you that sense of out of yourself that you need to be able to be ready to encounter a God.
When you see a shooting star today, is it an interesting scientific fact for you, or do you gasp in wonder?
Yes. It is both. And frankly, I think it's because I know the science that I'm even more in awe. It's one thing to say, oh, that's a pretty bit of light. It's another thing to say, I know what elements are creating that light. I know why it's that color. I know what I can learn from this. I hope some camera captured it so that I can measure not only, boy, was that pretty, but also, this is telling me something about dust from a comet. A cloud of dust left behind a comet that the Earth is barreling into, and like snowflakes hitting your windscreen, it's shots of light hitting our atmosphere. All of that adds to the joy. It doesn't take away from it.
This brings to mind the dynamic of different orders of knowledge, the rational and the poetic, the imaginative and the intellectual. And it seems to me that you marshal the same thought processes to cope with matters that are so vast, the cosmos, and yet matters that are so intimate, the soul.
You can't do the one without the other. You can't do science. You don't want to do science if you don't have that sense of awe, that sense of wonder. You can't believe in a creator God without experiencing creation. Otherwise, what's the point of believing?
And I know that you described in the 70s as a graduate student seeing Comet West, mm-hmm. and you said, was it impressive? No. It was frightening. It shook you to the core, you said. Why?
In the sky was a comet that looked like every photograph of a comet you'd ever seen. The kind of thing that you thought only existed in photographs. And it didn't belong there. And it was big, and it was scary, and it wasn't there yesterday, and what's going on? And then you understood why ancient people would look at comets as a portent of something really, really scary and different.
How might the church react if the NASA telescopes detect a really threatening near-Earth object hurtling towards us?
I'll be honest, we'll pray. What else can you do?
A meteor breaks through the atmosphere. Deep Impact, 1998.
I want to show an excerpt of a movie where physical and existential fear are just the shudder audiences go for. This is beautifully done.
Smoke trails from the giant fireball as it catapults into the ocean. From space, light flashes from the impact site, followed by sonic waves that spread across Earth as a mushroom cloud rises. On Earth, a towering tsunami engulfs an oil rig. It barrels toward a calm beach and houses on a coastline. In New York City, the wall of water knocks over and swallows buildings. It engulfs the Twin Towers. On the street, people flee. At a sprawling observatory.
Apart from Brother Guy's prayers, there are practical measures already in place. We are here at PAN-STARRS, the Panoramic Survey Telescope and Rapid Response System, located at the Hawaiian island of Maui.
Okay, brake is released. Everybody stand clear. I'm going to bring it down.
Here, one of the telescopes during maintenance.
Inside, Clive stands behind a woman as she grips a thick bar on a huge telescope and slowly pulls it downward. Words appear. Donna Rohr, PAN-STARRS telescope technician. On the telescope, a massive optical tube surrounds the lens. Outside at night, the Milky Way and thousands of stars light the sky. Inside the PAN-STARRS operational center,
Dr. Joanna Bulger is entrusted in a way with the safekeeping of humanity.
Joanna, a blonde woman, smiles.
And so is her colleague, Dr. Mark Willman. Just looking at their faces gave us a good amount of confidence.
They sit in front of computer screens.
They allowed us to intrude on their night watch.
Good evening.
Oh,
I found you. The night watch.
Yeah.
Hey, come on,
have a seat.
Helping to protect us from space rocks that might have hostile intent.
We were just observing, but we had to close up because the humidity shot up. So we're up to 90% now, and we have to close at 85 to protect the mirror. We don't want moisture on the mirror.
And how do you communicate with the controllers up at the telescope?
Oh, well, we are the controllers. There's nobody at the summit. It's all remote observing now. That's old school, where you had to drive up at the summit. It's 10,000 feet, so it's much more comfortable down here at 2,000 feet.
And so what have we got? I mean, this screen, I guess, is the night sky.
Yep, this is a map of the sky. You can see there's the zenith. That's straight overhead. And here's the telescope. And this was the target we were going to observe. We take about 60 images, and we get four images of the same spot in the sky. And so we have a tiny movie, a four-image movie then. And then we can pick out moving targets that way.
And you've got the largest cameras on Earth, isn't that
we
right?
Do.
Yeah, so I've got a 12-megapixel camera.
12 megapixels.
What's your camera?
Well, ours is over a billion pixels. So it's much larger than a consumer camera like that.
What is going on with this image here? Is this the pixel array?
Yeah, exactly. Itself? So this is actually the raw image that we take. So this is a 45-second exposure. And you can see the size of the camera itself. So we get a 3-degree field of view, which is roughly 7 square degrees on the sky. And the camera itself is stitched together of an 8x8 array of addressable CCDs. So if you actually, if we can click on one of these images, this one over here.
What's that? Is that a meteor there?
These are two satellites that we've caught in our field of view.
It is a satisfying job because, we don't want to go the way of the dinosaurs, and so it's worthwhile looking out for these things. Although the odds are slim that a big one is going to hit us anytime soon, but sooner or later, there will be a big one, so we're watching for it.
I do feel like I can sleep more soundly at night, knowing that there is always someone here in the night shift, you know, looking for inbound bolides. That's wonderful.
365 days a year.
Thank you. Night. Thank you very much for protecting us.
You're welcome. It's our privilege. Yeah.
The photos of the night sky are analyzed by Dr. Rob Warrick, a planetary defense researcher from Canada.
I can't believe this is the first time you've actually been to the telescope.
Yeah, well, normally I focus on the data analysis, reviewing the candidates. But yeah, so it's nice to have a chance to come see the telescope.
It's like seeing a sort of, you know, brother that you've never met before.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, they actually ended up opening at the end of the night for an hour and a half. We actually were able to review the data this morning, and so I found 6 new candidate objects.
We is you.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, it's really a team effort overall, but I'm the one that reviews it. So.
What's the most exciting object that you found?
So the most exciting object we found became to known as Oumuamua. It's actually the first interstellar comet. So it's a comet that came from outside our solar system. It's the first time we ever saw an object like this. Yeah.
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua. So it's actually a Hawaiian word. It means first messenger from afar. Yes.
Okay. Inside.
So it's actually a two-step process. The computer software isn't perfect, and it still requires manual review, and that's where I come in. So my main responsibility is to review all the nightly detections, and things that are real, they would show up as either a series of dots or trailed objects.
Are you the first person who's seen this?
Yes. So while the observers collect the data, I'm actually the first person on the planet to review and see this, and my submitting it would sound the alarm if there was an object that was a hazard to the Earth.
The alarm would instantly call the attention of NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office. Only a few people know that it exists. Responsible here is Dr. Kelly Fast, an astronomer.
I've heard you describe asteroids as the vermin of the solar system. Why do you call them that?
Well, certainly astronomers who are looking at things besides asteroids, they might be looking at their target, and asteroids are going to photobomb whatever they're looking at. So I guess from a point of view, if you're looking at something else, then they are the vermin of the solar system. From our point of view at NASA, they're fantastic for science, for spacecraft targets, but we also want to keep an eye on them because it's never good when two things occupy the same space at the same time. So we want to know if any of them are going to intersect Earth's orbit at a time when Earth is going to be there. There's dust hitting Earth's atmosphere all the time. We see shooting stars. That's just dust burning up in the atmosphere. But it's when things are larger, when you get up to the size of asteroids. Earth's atmosphere is fantastic for burning things up, but eventually things get too big for that to happen. Chelyabinsk, 20 meters, there was devastation. Tunguska, Siberia in 1908, that was probably a 40-meter asteroid.
Trees lie on the ground.
80 million trees were flattened by the blast, but not a single grain of the asteroid has ever been discovered.
Footage shows a devastated forest.
And defense, what can we do if there's a big sucker coming in at us? What can we do about it?
Well, yeah, the best defense is preparation, and so finding them first. You don't know how to mount a defense until you find them. So that is the first order of business, and that is going on with ground-based surveys. If you think of it as you've got the sun and you've got the Earth and the other planets going around the sun, like being on a racetrack, and then you've got all the asteroids going around the sun on the racetrack. And so there are many times when they might come close together. In fact, we have that often where there's a close approach where an asteroid comes close to Earth, which close might mean, you know, many lunar distances away. But let's say this is really large. It's a large very large asteroid, and you don't have a lot of time. There are the movies that show blowing them up. You don't necessarily have to do that. You just still need a good push. And you could use a nuclear explosive device that is used in some of these movies. But the idea is you would detonate it next to the asteroid, and the energy from that detonation would irradiate the surface, and the material that blows off the surface of the asteroid would give it that push in the other direction.
A softer, unaggressive approach was actually performed by a Japanese probe on asteroid Ryugu. How small the asteroid is, we can tell from the size of the shadow the probe casts on its surface.
The probe casts a small shadow.
Gravity is so minimal that the softest of landings already threw great quantities of debris away from it into space.
The probe floats away.
Right here we see how meteorites originate. The probe itself is already on its way back to Earth, bringing a single gram scooped from the asteroid. But for bigger specimens, Antarctica is paradise.
Icy glaciers stretch to the horizon.
It is not that more rocks fall here than elsewhere. They are visible on the vast glaciers that cover almost the entire continent that is larger than the United States. We were invited to join the hunt by South Korean scientists. Their station, named Changbogo, at the coast of East Antarctica, houses about 50 people.
A helicopter flies over the station.
The austral summer season lasts nearly 5 months, during which the sun never goes down.
Clive walks through the station.
Inside, it is more spacious than we anticipated. Only a few miles away, 6 men of Scott's last expedition endured a whole winter huddling in a snow cave just 9 feet across. They were starving and freezing in squalor, surviving on seal meat and a ration of 1 biscuit a day. From diaries of Scott's men, we know they dreamt of banquets that were ripped away from their ready forks. Only one man managed in his dream to actually eat, and he was rightfully hated by his comrades for this.
In a kitchen, a cook scrapes food from a pan onto a dish.
But we were not here for lobster and kimchi. We were itching to fly to the polar plateau in the interior. We knew there was an overland expedition of trucks that had left our station 3 weeks ago and was nearing the meteorite hunting grounds on the blue ice.
A red and white helicopter lifts off as another grounded helicopter's propeller spins. Later, the helicopter flies over an icy slope.
But first, the helicopter has to climb up some 2,000 meters. From the station at the coast to the ice plateau of the continent, we are flying over glacier ice cascading down. Imagine crossing this on foot. Each of these wildly tossed boulders is larger than an apartment building, and the mass is constantly flowing towards the sea.
Craggy glaciers fill the landscape.
Finally, we reach the plateau. Only a few mountains remain sticking out of the ice like islands. It felt like entering into a world that was not our planet.
A dark mountain sticks out of the flat, white land.
From here begins the immense loneliness of a vast continent, covered by ice 2 to 4 kilometers thick.
Far below the helicopter, a caravan stands out on the ice.
Through GPS data, we knew the position of the caravan. They were expecting us.
The helicopters descend toward the 7 all-terrain vehicles traveling slowly over the ice in a line. An industrial snowplow drags 2 trailers on sleds. After landing on the ground, Clive, in an orange jacket, hugs a man in a blue jacket.
We were so looking forward to meet Chong Ik Lee, the leader of this expedition. He was the one who invited us to Antarctica, and it felt like meeting an old friend.
I didn't think you'd make it.
Yes, yes.
I didn't know that we would make it.
My dream.
We had seen footage he shot close to here a few years earlier. He had found a large meteorite, and we fell in love with him, seeing his ecstasy of discovery. This is science at its best.
In video footage from 2014, John clambers out of a helicopter, races toward a meteorite the size of a cinder block on the snow, and lies on the ground beside it. He waves a colleague toward him. The colleague falls into his arms, hugs him, and rolls off. Zhang clenches his fists victoriously. Later, another colleague picks up the meteorite.
Groba!
Wow, you got a chincha! Deba, give me that!
Okay, now.
He sets it on the ice.
Something else I like about this highly charged emotional moment, something the stupid doctrine of film schools would never allow. Watch the background. A figure enters. No recognizable motivation. Wrong timing. Rear end approaching.
Behind Zhang, a man kneels on all fours on the ice with his backside to the camera. Now, Zhang rises from a crouch, crying. He hugs his cameraman.
Back to the present. Along with us, Chong Ik's wife, Mi Chung, had arrived, herself a renowned polar geologist.
Zhang and his wife embrace tightly. Wearing a fur hat and goggles, she hugs another team member, then returns to Zhang's side.
Husband and wife reunited.
Minutes after our arrival, we found our first meteorite. The sheer blank ice, not covered with snow, is the ideal terrain to spot them. The gigantic mass of ice is moving slowly like a conveyor belt and exposes stones that may have fallen hundreds of thousands of years ago.
A small meteorite rests on the ice.
Most of the meteorites are carried all the way to the ocean, but where the glacier is deflected upwards by a mountain range deep down there, the ice evaporates, leaving its cargo at the surface. Every stone out here is a meteorite.
A black pebble-sized meteorite stands out on the glimmering, snow-dusted ice. A shadow passes over it. Clive and Zhang's team hike in a spaced-out straight line across the ice away from the parked helicopters. The bright sun beams down on them. The flat white landscape stretches in all directions to the horizon and the blue sky. One of the men in line waves his arms.
Watch the man on the right. He found something.
the rest of the group treads toward him. He jumps up and down with his arms raised.
The lucky one turned out to be Clive. It may look staged, but it was really him.
Clive stands in front of a fist-sized meteorite.
I found one over there, a little one, and then when I...
It also turned out this was the largest meteorite of the entire season, and the first assessment suggested it was an extremely rare specimen.
Clive kneels before the black rock. Later, Clive stands near Jong, who walks over to a passenger leaning out the window of one of their vehicles.
We resumed our search, but one thought crept up on us. It would be a full 5 months until night would fall, and we could walk on for the next 5,000 kilometers without meeting a soul.
Wearing a backpack and orange snowsuit, Clive hikes along the unbroken, gleaming ice. Wisps of mist blow along the hard ground past his boots. The spread-out figures of Jung's team mark the horizon.
This is the ultimate experience of space for those on foot. But we knew of a place where not our feet, but our souls start to travel. A place where we transcend our human existence.
In an airplane cockpit.
Our last journey took us to one of the remotest islands of the archipelago in the Torres Strait. These islands are located between Australia and New Guinea. This tiny island called Mur has a population of about 400. We had heard of tribal beliefs about shooting stars that carry the souls of the deceased to a new life somewhere else.
People get off the small plane.
Duck Parsi, one of the tribal elders, knew stories about souls departing by meteor to the netherworld.
On a beach at sunset.
One of my family members was sent by the ghosts on the Maher.
Maher is a meteor.
Falling star, yeah. And she was actually on that Maher itself, burned with fire.
The bald dog nods earnestly.
That's what I heard. And they said that's a true story. And that lady, old lady named Gizu Simbolo.
Was she alive or is it her?
She was alive. She was alive. And when the family ready to die, the Maher can tell us a story saying, oh, someone we got lost in a few days or he goes somewhere else. The star, the falling star Maher. Sometimes red, sometimes light blue.
It seems here that death is, it's not so much an event, it's the beginning of a journey.
Beginning of the new journey on the new life. Yes.
Doug wears a flower-patterned headband.
They can come in different form. Form of a bird, form of a dog, form of a person. Or a shadow that you can see on the wall. Or maybe a floating wood. Floating wood on the ocean.
He gestures out to the calm ocean beyond him and Clive.
Because we came with a camera, the islanders revived an almost forgotten dance that was not performed here for half a century.
Three men in grass skirts spread out in front of a gray-haired man in a green shirt.
Alo Tapim, an elder, instructed young men in the choreography.
They practice beneath a roof in an outdoor communal area surrounded by trailers. Allo, the elder, holds up a water bottle and taps it on both sides of his head. The shirtless dancers mark out the steps with their bare feet on the brick floor scattered with dry leaves. Their heels tap the ground. On the beach at sunset, four male dancers perform on the sand. Their shadows stretch out in front of them. A group of islanders sit on the beach nearby in brightly patterned shirts, some with drums in their laps. Allo sits among them.
The dance is about Maier, as you've indicated. Maier is that star, comet, and it's a special star.
Allo looks toward the sky.
Only on special time that this star appear to the Miriam people, the Miriam observe this star. When the loved one departs this life to the next, that transition is done through this star. The dancers carrying ne, torches. We call it ne. They carry them. And they indicate when that star, falling star, let go its embers. It's indicated by the fire sticks they carry. And when the two fire sticks, they clap, clap together the two fire sticks, the embers.
His hands move down.
And this is captured, that tells, describes that star. Yes, and this is our story.
Allo nods. The orange sun reflects on the ocean. The shirtless dancers stand poised before the seated islanders. They wear grass skirts and leafy armbands on one bicep. At night, each man holds two long torches in a fire on the sand. In the near darkness, the fire from the men's torches glows. The four men stand in a staggered horizontal line and stomp the sand with their bare feet. In unison, they bend their knees, turn to one side, and sweep their torches to the sky, then do the same on the other side. They hop lightly from foot to foot, then turn and pit their two torches together. With outstretched arms, they jump on one foot, kneel, and tap their torches together again. They squat down and lift their knees high as they shuffle their feet on the sand. The dancers swing their torches low and clap them together, sending embers falling. The bonfire burns nearby. Trees on a hill beyond them are silhouetted by the violet and periwinkle sky. The dancers lift their torches in time with their stomping feet. They each circle one arm and bring the torches together, then circle it again and kneel in the sand. They rub together the ends of their torches and stand back up. Firelight glows on the drums and faces of the singing islanders. Embers scatter from the fire at the end of one of the dancers' torches. As the sky darkens and the dance continues, the falling embers and flames on their torches shine bright orange. Embers from the bonfire sail upward to the night sky. Fade to black. Credits appear. Directed by Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer. Written and narrated by Werner Herzog. Producers Andre Singer, Lucky Stepetic. Executive producer Richard Millman. Executive producers Greg Boosted, Jessica Harrop. Executive producers Anna Gottes, Ollie Harbottle. Editor Marco Cabalbo. Director of Photography Peter Zeitlinger, ASC BVK. Original music Ernst Reisiger. Credits roll. Copyright 2020 Spring Films Limited and Werner Herzog Film, GmbH. This film has been described by Pixelogic Media, voiced by Darren Revitz.